Chapter 7. The World Outside. In May 1963, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, then Minister for External Affairs of Pakistan, declared, "Pakistan has arrived at peaceful settlement with all neighbouring countries, like China, Nepal, Afghanistan and Burma, except, unfortunately, India, which refuses to make the necessary adjustments to bring lasting peace to the subcontinent. I hope we can give undivided attention to one question which Pakistan faces, solution of the Kashmir problem." This quote remains relevant even today. The political idea of Pakistan, propagated from 1940 on, and which bore quick, if blighted, fruit in 1947, had roots in regions which, as we heard at the start of this narrative, had connections to the outside world through the seas and by land. The Arabian Sea, the Persian Gulf, and the Bay of Bengal, on the one hand, and the Silk Road, the Khyber Pass, and the Great Trunk Road, on the other, had served as corridors for ideas, goods, and armies for thousands of years. Contemporary political imaginations, Cold War geopolitical relations, and post-Cold War globalization are variations on older themes. However, there has been one important change. While previously this ancient land was seen as one of opportunity to which people were drawn, today it is mostly the opposite. Love thy neighbour? Within 2 months and 10 days of partition, in October 1947, the governments of India and Pakistan were at an undeclared war over one of its items of unfinished business, the then princely state of Jammu and Kashmir. Pakistan feared that Jammu and Kashmir, among the largest, most strategically located of regions, would accede to India. Communal relations in the state were difficult. An unpopular Hindu Maharaja of the Dogra dynasty ruled over a Muslim majority population, whose most popular leader nursed an ambition of regional self-determination. Theoretically free at the end of British paramountcy, 1858 to 1947, the 550-plus princely states in the subcontinent were effectively at the mercy of the rising tide of mass populism on the one hand, and the relevant imperatives of their geography, demography, military and ideology on the other. The case of Jammu and Kashmir was especially sensitive. For Pakistan, it was difficult to imagine a border area with a Muslim majority population belonging to India, given the two-nation theory and its logical conclusion in the partition of British India. For India, by the same token, it was important to ideologically refute Pakistan's raison d'etre by showing that India was a country for all communities. The Kashmiri ruler, veering between dreams of independence and declaration for India, saw sections of his population rise against him, soon aided and abetted by tribesmen entering from Pakistani territory. As he sought military assistance from India, New Delhi extracted the political price of accession to India, and Karachi responded accordingly, triggering the first India-Pakistan war. Amidst this power play, the Kashmiri people, living in the famed Vale of Srinagar, but also in other regions like Jammu, Poonch, and Gilgit-Baltistan, were caught up in this India-Pakistan binary. Since then, stereotypes of Kashmir's scenic beauty, torn between the two rivals competing for the territory, have set the tropes of this dispute, be it in academia or fiction, such as Salman Rushdie's novel Shalimar, the Clown. This has thwarted an understanding of Kashmiri nationalism while not ushering in any kind of peace, with or without honour, in the region. Periods of surface calm have been underlain by passages of occupation and challenges to it. Meanwhile, on the map, the ceasefire line of 1949 turned into the line of control of 1972, and on the ground, Kashmir remains trifurcated, with the Kashmiri people split between an India-administered, a Pakistan-held, and a China-controlled triangle. Neither of the principal parties has dared to hold a plebiscite in any part of the state. This denial of national self-determination to 12 million people militarized by India and 4 million people by Pakistan has seen demands of azadi, freedom, on both sides, albeit more in India. After successive waves of uprising from the late 1980s to the late 2010s, on the 5th of August 2019, the government of India, under the Hindu nationalist government of the Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, revoked the state's special status and reduced it to directly controlled union territories. The government of Pakistan, meanwhile, has its own arrangements for the part of Kashmir under its administration, as well as the northern areas adjacent to Chinese Xinjiang, called Gilgit-Baltistan. Greater interrogation of these Kashmirs with India and Pakistan is afoot, which papers over the fact that this is one of the most militarized regions in the world. India's grave human rights abuses in the Valley of Kashmir for at least the past 30 years have been met with Pakistan's perennial Janus-faced approach to the issue. Covert support and overt rhetoric for helping the angry young men perpetuate their conflict, but towards whose desired end? The toxic mix of elevated nationalism and religion, but also petty political dishonesty, has meant that the Kashmir Valley may well be on its way to becoming a bigger version of the Gaza Strip, or the West Bank, if not Tibet. The administrative shifts taking place are clear, with the Indian state's desire for a form of settler colonialism paralleling the demographic change achieved in Tibet by the Chinese state since 1959, and by the Israeli state in Palestine. Four wars, 1947, 1965, 1971, 1999, almost daily border skirmishes, tit-for-tat meddling in insurgencies, Kashmir, Balochistan, Indian Punjab, and the hyper-masculine nationalism sweeping across the subcontinent see majoritarian loyalty to these authoritarian states. If the end of empire was far from clean, then the emergence of the Cold War in the region was equally messy. Pakistan courted the USA before and under Ayub Khan in the 1950s to 1960s, while Zulfikar Bhutto increasingly looked towards Mao's China and the Organization of Islamic Conference in the 1970s. Zia received a godsend opportunity in the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which renewed US interest in Pakistan after 1979, while the Saudi royal house, long close to the USA, was also keen to nip in the bud any varieties of socialism, no matter if Islamic. Zia's vision for Pakistan was the perfect fit for the Saudis, and what emerged was an alliance of religious parties, strategic interests, and despotic leaderships, all bankrolled by American and petrodollars. All this was simultaneously strained and strengthened by the rise of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the 1990s to 2000s. Since 2000, Pakistan has been hyphenated increasingly less with India and more with its other neighbour, Afghanistan. They share a 1,500-mile border that in parts is soft and porous, with overlapping ethnicities and socio-cultural practices. Much more than the mid-20th century Radcliffe line with India, Pakistan's political relationship with Afghanistan has been bedeviled by the late 19th century Durand line, a colonial artifact that has been contested by successive Afghan governments. They refused to accept the loss of territories east of the line and the consequent severing of the people's ties across this political boundary, and in 1947, Afghanistan was the only country to vote against the entry of Pakistan to the UN. The idea of a greater Pakhtunistan lived on for a while, carrying the legacy of the troubled frontier, a colonial inheritance. Significantly, Pakistan has also been a refuge, hosting one of the largest refugee populations in the world. Afghans first started to flee en masse when Soviet forces stormed the Taj Beg Palace, Kabul, and assassinated the Afghan president Hafizullah Amin in December 1979. 11 years later, there were an estimated 3.7 million Afghans in Pakistan. The civil war that followed the withdrawal of the Soviet troops and saw the Taliban take over government in Kabul by 1996, only enlarged this population, with accompanying challenges to house, feed, and employ them. Pakistan, along with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, UAE, was one of the first countries to recognize Taliban rule, and security studies literature abounds with descriptions of the Pakistani state's run with the hare and hunt with the hounds role in its rise. Any repatriation of refugees was halted by the events of 9/11 and the War on Terror from 2003. By then, the UNHCR estimated that 5 million Afghan refugees were in refugee camps in Pakistan. Of late, Pakistan's relationship with Afghanistan has waxed and waned, affected by American intentions, Indian interventions, and the investments of both. Perhaps the greatest legacy of this was Zia's survival in power until 1988, given the Americans' need for him to create a Vietnam for the Red Army in Afghanistan. 15 years later, US troops would be back in Afghanistan, and this time among the beneficiaries would be another Pakistan general-turned-president, Pervez Musharraf. In this repeating cycle of history, the ultimate price was paid by the people and places in Pakistan. The country was flooded by nefarious funds, weapons, and narcotics, often travelling between the seaport of Karachi and the gateway to the north, Peshawar. These cities have remained a hub for political, ethnic, religious, and drug-related violence, in which arms travelling to and from Afghanistan found a happy home. Apart from creating a culture of normalised everyday violence, the resulting volatility has weakened the economic position of Pakistan by inevitably deterring foreign investment. While courting the West, chiefly Americans, but also the British, from within or without the confines of the Commonwealth, Pakistan remains one of the biggest recipients of UK aid. Pakistan has also had a close relationship with Communist China. This so-called all-weather friendship was formally forged in 1963, when the two countries signed a border agreement delimiting the territory along the Karakoram mountain range. China has ever since proved to be a reliable friend in need, especially when the USA and the UK have not. After all, their alliance has as much, if not more, to do with countering India than with anything else. It was no coincidence that the 1963 agreement came soon after India was defeated in its 1962 war with China. Slightly prior to this, a partnership had started in 1959 to build the Karakoram Highway, linking Kashgar in Xinjiang to Islamabad via the Khunjarab Pass, which follows the path of the ancient Silk Road. The rather scenic highway was fully completed in 1978 and opened to the public in its entirety in 1986. The present Chinese government's Belt and Road Initiative builds, in many respects, on this example, with a larger-scale resurrection of the Silk Road through this region. At the South Asian heart of BRI is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, CPEC, which envisages Chinese investments in Pakistan amounting to $62 billion. Through this project, China will help in a wide spectrum of infrastructure projects, from power, electricity, to road and rail transport. The centrepiece is the development of the deep-sea Gwadar port on the far southwestern coast of Balochistan. The administrative control of the port is handled by Pakistan's Maritime Secretary, while the operational control is held by the little-known China Overseas Port Holding Company. This provides China with an access to the Arabian Sea, Persian Gulf, and the Indian Ocean. In the making since 1998, work started in 2002 and was completed 4 years later. In many ways, it was the launchpad for the CPEC, which took off over 2013 to 2015. These substantial investments in Pakistan are crucial because Pakistan's economy has suffered significantly since 2001 and foreign investment in the country has dropped dramatically due to security concerns. After the election of President Trump, US assistance and aid programs declined substantially. This drop has been countered by investments from the Saudi crown, which has pledged $20 billion, and the UAE, pledging $3 billion. While Beijing has continued to be the all-weather friend, the political price to be paid is also obvious. Most visible is the silence of Islamabad on the question of the treatment of the Muslim Uyghurs in Xinjiang, China. Pakistan's refusal to criticize Beijing on their persecution is in contrast to its sharp criticism of human rights abuses in Kashmir, Palestine, and Myanmar. The Pakistani diaspora. The overseas Pakistani community number around 9 million people, and half of those are based in the Gulf states. The UK has the largest Pakistani diaspora community outside the Gulf, with over 1 million people, while substantial numbers also live in the United States, 500,000 plus, and Canada, 200,000 plus. These groups have emerged from different waves of migration and settlement, often reflecting and responding to colonialism, the world wars, and regional changes. Given that this is one of the largest diaspora populations in the world, it has curiously drawn little academic research. This may be partly because the earlier phases of migration, until the 1970s, were often understood collectively within a South Asian context, while the post-1970s numbers have increasingly been incorporated within a global Muslim diaspora. But Pakistanis overseas are as diverse as their country and make a big contribution to the Pakistani economy via their remittances. The Pakistani diaspora has developed largely since the 1970s, but smaller numbers also migrated following independence in 1947. Post-war reconstruction and labour shortages in the UK were an important factor in attracting men from the Commonwealth, including small numbers of Pakistanis. Equally important were professionals such as doctors. However, the majority of the Pakistani diaspora in the UK comes from Mirpur, a small district in its part of Kashmir. There has been a history of migration from this area since the 1940s, but following the construction of the Mangla Dam in the early 1960s, there was a sharp increase. This was partly due to the displacement caused by the construction of the dam, but also because the British contractor behind the dam was assisting the displaced residents. This cheap labour started life in manufacturing and shifted into the service sector, or, as Virinder Kalra put it in his influential work From Textile Mills to Taxi Ranks, in northern British towns and in the 1970s to 1980s, sent back remittances that enabled Mirpur to prosper much more than the rest of Pakistan. Brand new markets catered for diaspora taste buds. Grand houses were built to display the newly acquired televisions and videos. All this in a small, remote area adjacent to North Punjab in rural Pakistan. With Mirpur being in the politically contested territory of Kashmir, there are layers to identity politics here. Mirpuris often identify themselves ethnically as Kashmiris, amidst whom is a strand that would like to see a nation of Kashmir independent of India and Pakistan. Their migration story is thus connected to wider questions of competing diasporic identity and Kashmiri nationalism. Away from Britain, the Gulf has been the choice destination for the vast majority of Pakistanis. The oil boom of the 1970s propelled the old seafaring trade links across the Arabian Sea and through the Persian Gulf. People from large swathes across the subcontinent responded to the demand for labour in Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Many Pakistanis were eager to leave the grim economic conditions and mass nationalisation of industry by Bhutto and were lured by the construction and developments taking place in the Gulf. The new middle class in Pakistan can be considered in part a creation of this group and its financial injections into a fragile economy, enabling urban centres and rural development. This class is characterised by their disposable income and conspicuous consumption, reflected in the growth of restaurants, malls, multiplexes, etc. in urban cities, and also a concomitant religious revivalism and spiritual piety. In 2019, the value of their remittances was $21.8 billion, with $5 billion from Saudi Arabia alone. Imran Khan's government, capitalizing on the PTI's popularity in the diaspora, has been encouraging Pakistanis overseas to remit back home to save the cash-strapped economy and to build Naya Pakistan. The relationship between Pakistan and Saudi Arabia has only gone from strength to strength. In intergovernmental matters, the kingdom has offered Pakistan generous economic assistance, and in recent years, the two countries have been cooperating militarily too. The best illustration of this is the appointment in 2017 of General Rahil Sharif, Pakistan's former Chief of Army Staff, 2013 to 2016. As the Commander-in-Chief of the Islamic Military Counter-Terrorism Coalition of 39 countries, with its headquarters in Riyadh. As already noted, Saudi Arabia has had great impact on the religious and cultural landscape of Pakistan. Added to its substantial funding of madrasas, religious schools, that are closely aligned to a more puritanical version of Islam, Ahli Hadith, practiced there, is the symbolism of the iconic Shah Faisal Mosque, the largest in Pakistan, funded with $120 million from the kingdom in 1976 and named after King Faisal. Indeed, the design of the mosque by the Turkish architect Vedat Dolakay pays homage to the Arabian Bedouin tent. Then there is the renaming of colonial Lailpur as Faisalabad in 1979 after King Faisal. Faisalabad is not only one of the leading commercial centres in Pakistan, but also functions as a hub for entrepreneurs and overseas workers. This relationship with Saudi Arabia, complementing the changes in Pakistan after the independence of Bangladesh, saw the Islamic Dhow sail away from its subcontinental mooring. However, this assertion of a stronger Islamic identity of the Saudi brand has meant tetchy relations with the neighbouring Shia-majority Iran, as well as the more Europeanised Turkey. Whether it was the Iran-Pakistan natural gas pipeline continuing into India, or the popularity of Turkish television dramas in Pakistani drawing rooms, amending the text of the penal code along Sunni Sharia lines is one thing. Ignoring a near neighbour and a more distant but long-standing influence, Turkish law in subcontinental politics goes back to the Khilafat movement of a century ago, is quite another. Furthermore, relations with the kingdom have not always been smooth. Over 500,000 Pakistanis have been deported from Saudi Arabia between 2012 and 2019 over expired visas and other offences. In September 2019, Riyadh abruptly decided to reject postgraduate medical degrees from Pakistan. And in any case, working conditions in the Arabian Peninsula have never been appealing. There are numerous accounts of employers withholding passports, of unpaid wages, and poor working conditions. Despite all this, approximately 2.5 million Pakistanis live in Saudi Arabia. The allure of making it abroad to escape the immediate economic hardships at home is too strong. The price that such escape can entail was brought home in the 2013 film Zinda Bahag, Run Alive, directed by Fajad Nabi and Minu Gur, which portrayed the issue of illegal migration painfully through the experiences of three friends, each of whom tried to cross borders illegally with the risk of death if they did not succeed. The film, representing the re-emergence of independent cinema, was Pakistan's official entry for the best foreign language film at the Academy Awards that year. The changing contours of the cinematic portrayal of Pakistan poignantly capture changing perceptions and identities, those of self and the other. The comedy drama East is East, directed by Damien O'Donnell, 1999, set in Salford, UK in 1971, brings to life the story of one family headed by a Pakistani man and the challenges of his children growing up in Britain. By contrast, the 2012 film The Reluctant Fundamentalist, directed by Mira Nair, based on Mohsin Hamid's novel, is a political thriller depicting the conflict between the American dream and a re-evaluation of self and its sovereignty in an American society that treats any Muslim with suspicion. The inside-outside dichotomy of contemporary Pakistan is that of an increasingly Islamic country in an increasingly Islamophobic world. Ziauddin Sadar, the British Pakistani scholar, suggests that Pakistanis have a love-hate relationship with America. There are those who want to migrate there, and at the same time, the USA is also perceived as a meddling villain, especially since the War on Terror began. Of course, Pakistan has also received significant sums in American aid over the decades. Although the character Shangiz in Hamid's novel goes back to Pakistan, the real population of Pakistanis in the USA has only continued to grow. From 30,000 in 1980, it is now over 500,000. Pakistanis in the USA mostly come from cities such as Lahore, Karachi, Rawalpindi, Faisalabad, Hyderabad, and Peshawar. Most have settled in New York, New Jersey, and California, seeking better opportunities across white-collar sectors. This group is different from those who have migrated to the UK and the Gulf states in terms of its class and cultural capital. But among this group are also the persecuted Ahmadiyyas, declared non-Muslim in 1974, as well as illegal migrants, such as those depicted in Zinda Bahag, who take on poorly paid jobs, becoming taxi drivers, newspaper vendors, waiters, and petrol pump attendants, all having been lured by the American dream. In between the tectonic political shifts inside, Bangladesh 1971, and outside, 9/11, lay the Salman Rushdie affair of 1988 to 1989. Rushdie, whose magical realist novels related to Indian independence, Midnight's Children, 1981, and the creation of Pakistan, Shame, 1983, had touched these countries' sensitivities by taking on the life of the Prophet Muhammad in his fourth novel, The Satanic Verses, 1988. With a fatwa calling for his death issued by the Supreme Leader of Iran in February 1989, the novelist became the news himself, overtaking the contents of his book, which had been banned in both India and Pakistan. As Ziauddin Sadar remarked, looking back on the episode 20 years later, "The Rushdie affair had no place for reasoned Muslim opinion. It was structured on the assumption that those who question or criticize Rushdie's right to say what he said are, by definition, barbarians. Thus, the only valid Muslim opinion was the extremist one, and the only Muslim voices that could be heard were of those who supported the fatwa. This dynamic justified the perception that Islam represented, in Rushdie's words, the darkness of religion." This has presented a peculiar dilemma in Pakistan ever since, on themes such as internal reform, secularism, perpetual doubt, and above all, as Ziauddin Sadar asked, whether a single way of being Muslim can be a ray of light for all Muslims. These questions have no easy answers, and thus an escape, whether via pull or push factors, to wherever there is a potential for a better life abroad, is an obvious attraction. More than the economic migrants, it is the individuals who are hounded or forced to flee for fear of persecution whose plight is disturbing. Among these have been journalists speaking against the state. Pakistan is 145 out of 180 in the World Press Freedom Index, 2020. And members of the dwindling minorities, most recently the Christian woman Asia Bibi, who was acquitted on blasphemy charges but sought asylum in France in 2020. Others on the peripheries of the homogeneous society that is being forged include LGBTQ people. Although Pakistan's parliament passed a law in 2019 guaranteeing basic rights for transgender citizens, the social stigma attached to them in a discriminatory society leads to attacks, forcing many to seek sanctuary in the outside world. Sport, politics, and social change. If there is one thing which sounds the jingoistic trumpets in India and Pakistan, it is cricket. The most popular sport in South Asia, cricket provides entertainment, money, hero worship, and villainy, and manages to rouse the mildest of nationalists. Equally, to many, this spectacle is a vulgar travesty, a distraction from the structural poverty and inequality in the region. Verily, an opium of the masses. It has usurped the place of field hockey, the official national game that formed the source of bragging rights between the 1950s and 1970s, especially at the Melbourne 1956, Rome 1960, and Tokyo 1964 Olympic Games, when India and Pakistan contested three successive finals. Pakistan's last gold medal was won at Los Angeles 1984, with the charismatic Hassan Sadar, and the last medal, bronze, at Barcelona 1992, under centre-forward Shahbaz Ahmed. In the same time span, Pakistan also had two world champions in Jahangir and Jansa Khan in the game of squash. Cricket, its popular one-day form in addition to the classical five-day version, emerged as the leading sport from the late 1970s, and Pakistan, having co-hosted, with India, the World Cup in 1987, won the 1992 edition under the captaincy of Imran Khan. The colonial roots of cricket in South Asia cannot be overlooked, but the subcontinent, including Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, has made the game its own. Like the colonial rulers and their princely collaborators, cricket in British India remained a remote, urban and elite preserve up until the 1930s, when India gained test status and a team toured England. In the aftermath of the Second World War, cricket resumed in late colonial India, soon to be overtaken by the partition disturbances. Afterwards, cricket ties were among the first to be resumed, and a Pakistan team travelled to India in 1952 for its maiden test tour. In the next decade, the countries took turns to host each other, but a majority of these games were drawn, as neither side could either overpower the other or, crucially, take risks to win, fearing a loss of face. This was still better than what followed between 1961 and 1978, when there was a complete stoppage of play between the two countries as political relations deteriorated. Meanwhile, cricket's popularity continued in both countries, with PTV broadcasting matches from the late 1960s, paving the way for the more frenzied popular fan following that we associate with the game today. By 1978, the political climate had changed in both countries, and over the next 5 years, they regularly played each other. Ironically, it was the puritanical General Zia who most effectively used the idea of cricket diplomacy with his message of cricket for peace and journeying to Jaipur, India, in 1987 to watch a cricket match with the Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi at a tense time of military standoff. Through the late 1980s and the 1990s, as bilateral tours endured another barren decade, Sharjah, UAE, emerged as the home away from home for the two teams, given its increasing expatriate population from the subcontinent. In between, in 1996, Pakistan again co-hosted, with India and Sri Lanka, a Cricket World Cup, and played its part in shifting the popular balance of power away from the traditional holders, the British, white Commonwealth. The 1999 Pakistan trip to India came at a sensitive time, after the two countries had conducted their nuclear tests in 1998 and just before the Kargil War of summer 1999. Acting as an icebreaker, the game at least provided a forum for some people-to-people exchange. Sporting visas were issued. The years 2004 to 2008, when Pakistan and India played four back-to-back bilateral tours, now appear a golden age. Since the terrorist attack in Mumbai in November 2008, the two countries have only played each other on foreign soil. What has been most striking is how much of this rivalry has seeped through into the general body politic and how much the administration of the game oozes with state propaganda. Therefore, the rather lucrative Indian Premier League of the shortest, the most popular, and heavily monetized version of the game has excluded Pakistani players since its inaugural season in early 2008. Indeed, since the attack on the Sri Lankan team in Lahore in March 2009, Pakistan went an entire decade without hosting the international cricket community. However, changes in attitudes are not limited to just this bilateral rivalry. The Pakistan team has also visibly changed, reflecting the wider transformation of society and the cultural landscape. The Pakistani journalist Nadeem Farooq Paracha has argued that cricket culture reflects the wider socio-political mindset. Cricket has been more than a mere game for the colonized countries in the subcontinent, as in the Caribbean. Pakistan's first cricket captain was the Oxford-educated Abdul Hafiz Kadar. Initially, the players were mainly from the two leading cosmopolitan centres, Lahore and Karachi. There was no representation in the national team from East Pakistan, despite having the majority population. In the past 30 years, the players' pool has widened to smaller towns and provincial areas. One visible change over the years has been the players' public display of religiosity, most prominently exhibited and associated with the captaincy of Inzamam ul-Haq, 2003-2007. From being the preserve of Oxford Blues and the Lahori landed elite, mingled with street fighters from Karachi, half the cricket team were now connected with the revivalist millenarian Tablighi Jamaat movement. In 2008, it prompted a Pakistan journalist to write about the Islamization of Pakistani cricket. The Tablighi Jamaat's largely apolitical and humanitarian stance has proved to be particularly popular amongst the rising middle class in Pakistan. At the same time, its members wear their religiosity and mark their bodies and conduct accordingly. In 2006, the Pakistan Cricket Board was forced to issue a warning to the players about striking a balance between religion and cricket. By contrast, state endorsement and social excitement has been muted when it comes to women playing sports. Although numbers are small and their public profile limited, nevertheless, many women have been able to break the barriers despite the odds. In 1996, two young sisters, Shazia and Sharmeen Khan from Karachi, led the way in establishing a women's cricket team recognised by the Pakistan Cricket Board. Despite the backlash, which included death threats and court cases, the sisters cleared the path for the team's participation in the Women's World Cup in 1997. That women's cricket in Pakistan is much more accepted and has grown tremendously since was seen in the accolades that poured in on the retirement of former captain Sana Mir in 2020 after a 15-year international career as a premier all-rounder. But right-wing religious groups continue to target events such as the mixed marathon race in Gujranwala in 2005, which gained much attention in Pakistan and abroad. Sporting bodies have since sought to accommodate the concerns of religious conservatives by following strict dress codes, having segregated training facilities, and ensuring the safety of the players so that they can continue to participate in sports. Today, nowhere is the motif of cricket in Pakistan more useful as a prism of social change than right at the very top, in the life and times of the present Prime Minister, Imran Khan. Born in 1952, Khan has roots from his maternal side that are now on the other side of the Radcliffe Line in Jalandhar, India. He was born into a Pashtun family from Lahore, which already had cricket stars in his cousins, for example, Majid Khan. After schooling in England and an Oxford degree, Khan made his debut in Test cricket with the Pakistan team against England in June 1971, when Pakistan still had two wings, and would cap a glittering 21-year career by winning the 1992 Cricket World Cup. After raising money to establish the first cancer hospital in Pakistan in 1994, later his springboard into politics, he married into the Goldsmith family and established his political party, the PTI, in 1996. What followed was a slow and to many a shocking 22-year transformation from cricketing icon and playboy to pious philanthropist and conservative politician who finally reached the top, with some help along the way from the military establishment, in August 2018. The colonial legacies were very much in evidence in 1971 when Imran Khan took his first steps in international cricket, representing a country barely 25 years old. It is apt in many ways that another rebirth of Pakistan is now taking place on his watch, even if not entirely at his behest. Imran Khan, with his spiritual mentor spouse in Purdar and his ever-visible rosary beads, represents this Naya Pakistan, which is youthful and restless, aspirational, but also directionless, seeking to break through old barriers of land, class, and caste, but also stymied by the military-industrial-religious complex. His successful conversion from a global icon to representing a narrowly defined nationalist Pakistan says more about the society in which he is embedded.